Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, February 11th. I'm Ray Graff. Snow, sleet, freezing rain recently swept across the Northeast, leading to power outages for thousands. But the lights and mics are on in the studio, and meteorologist Jason Goff has made it through the storm to answer your weather questions. Formerly of News Channel 13 in Albany, Jason now runs a great forecasting website, jasonsweather.com. If you have a question about dew points, the wind chill, even the odd Alberta clipper, give us a call. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Meteorologist Jason Goff and your weather calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We are joined today once again by meteorologist Jason Goff, who is here to answer your weather questions. Formerly of News Channel 13 in Albany, Jason's forecasts have been broadcast right here on AMC for years. He now runs a forecasting website, jasonsweather.com. If you have a question about the weather, give us a call, 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff, welcome back, sir.
Thank you very much, sir. How are you?
Good. How's the website?
The website is going great. I'm having a great time with that. I've been tinkering around and doing some other things in Albany, so I've just been maintaining it, and I added an audio forecast on there this morning. Actually, it was the first day I did that, so you'll be able to, if you can just click on that, you can hear it.
Oh, cool.
Or you can read it. But no, it's been great. And I actually was just looking at the New York State Mesonet site.
What's that?
Folks are it's basically a state version of the National Weather Service that Governor Cuomo put together with University at Albany. It's a fantastic site. They have 126 stations around the state. And I love to look at it because I can get, they have a webcam there for each of the sites. You can get all the data that you need.
So what kind of real-time data are we talking about here?
It updates every 5 minutes.
So barometric pressure and what else you got there?
Yeah, dew point, pressure, wind. You can look back and see. It's really neat because you can find out, you know, in some of these spots, it may be at the foothills of the Adirondacks or the Catskills. You can see where that cold air kind of pools together and you get these wild temperature fluctuations. But it's really cool stuff. But the amazing thing is, as I was shaking my head ruefully here, the temperatures in and around the Capital Region have barely budged since 4 this morning when I was up. They've come up in the Adirondacks to the low 30s out of the mid-20s, but that's it. It's not the prettiest day we've ever seen out there,
it's
Ray.
It's gloomy.
And it is.
From what I understand, and of course I do get any number of alarming emails from weather services of one kind or another, usually commercial ventures.
Yes.
And they're telling me, man, it's going to get very cold and possibly some snow toward the end of the week.
Yeah, a little bit of snow Thursday morning, so the commute Thursday morning will be slower anyway. In and around the Capital District, you know, a couple of inches as it looks now, starting late Wednesday into early Thursday. And then actually I wrote a piece about it this morning. We have not had a below zero reading in Albany. We've got our first legit shot at that Friday night, Saturday morning. So it'll be the coldest temperatures that we've seen so far this winter.
And I understand that this cold snap, or whatever they call it, is really, it's going a good 1,500 miles from the North Plains all the way up to Maine. So what is going on there?
Oh, just a big typical trough that we get in the winter. I mean, this winter has actually been rather atypical because we've had, January was tied 6th warmest on record. I did this too. I was in full Cliff Clavin mode this morning, Ray. I had, the first day of winter, which is December 21st, that is 54 days. Five of those 54 days have had a high temperature below freezing.
Wow.
Which is amazing. Considering the whole month of January, on average, again, it's just an average, but is either 31 or 30 degrees. So it has been a remarkably, relatively anyway, mild winter. And this shot, if we don't get zero in Albany or below zero Albany Friday night, Saturday morning, I think it may end up being our only chance to do that.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, how would you know that? Now, you've often told me, you know, beyond a week, 10 days, it's a crapshoot.
It is when you're trying to forecast, you know, smaller scale features, you know, even like a nor'easter is considered a smaller scale feature in the grand scheme of things. But just the way that the pattern is looking and the way that things have been, and time is really on our side. I mean, the sun angle is getting greater, and, you know, we typically run out of these. And climatologically, we'll have 10 days below zero in Albany. Most of those come in December and January, and then only 3 out of 10 on average happen in February. So I don't see it. I think even though we'll have this glancing blow of a, you know, a pretty good little cold shot, but it'll be in and out of here pretty quickly. And then by next week, by Monday, we may be back to 40 again.
Jason Goff is our guest here on Vox Pop. It's the weather, meteorology today, 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's see. I don't know if you were on Vox Pop, but I know I was hosting the roundtable, and we called you when the big storm was happening,
yes.
3 days of snow.
Yes.
It seems, and again, when you're in the middle of it, it's tough to get perspective, but it seems like it's been an odd front-loaded winter. We had that huge storm.
Mm-hmm.
We got buried.
Yep.
And then not so much around here in the Capital District.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we had whatever we've had this year so far, 35 inches of snow total, but 23 of that almost came just in that one storm. So, you know, it has. It's been a little bit of a goofy winter. Our coldest high temperature of the winter so far is 18 degrees. I mean, you know, if you're from like Florida or Georgia or, you know, California, you go, well,
that's
18
cold.
Is pretty cold. But when that's your coldest high temperature of the winter, and here we are at whatever is today is the February 11th, that's a pretty remarkable stretch that we've had here in the great Northeast.
It's almost shirt sleeve weather, really, for
that's
around here.
That's what I'm saying, man.
Jason Goff, our guest, 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Let's go to Patrick in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania. Patrick.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You're on.
So my question is, why does everybody put much stock into what the groundhog says when all the things the groundhog says turns out to be a big lie?
Well, I assure you, he's not doing it on purpose. That's one. Two, I don't know how many Vox Pops I've done, Ray. It's been a bunch.
Oh, yeah.
I think this is our first call from Pennsylvania, I think.
Well, we get them from time to time.
Once in a while?
I don't know where Beach Lake is, though. Where is that, Patrick?
Where is Beach Lake, Patrick?
Where's Beach Lake? It's in Pennsylvania.
Where in Pennsylvania?
It's, I think, between Honesdale and White Mills.
You think. Okay, well, fair enough.
Well, so we'll answer your question now. As far as why does everybody that's a bit of an overstatement, I think. Nobody with a meteorology degree takes the groundhog's prediction seriously. It's just one of those fun little things to talk about and to do whatever. And
how did it start?
You know, that's a good question. I mean,
what was somebody drunk at the weather service? Hey, I got an idea. Let's see if the groundhog sees a shadow. What do you think, Bob?
It's been going on for a long time. I mean, over 100 years. And the interesting thing is, this year he did not see his shadow, nor did he last year. So it's the first time.
What does that mean? I forget what it means.
So if the groundhog does not see his shadow, that means it'll be in early spring, according to legend.
All right.
According to weather records, maybe not so much. But when you're talking about, you know, the second year in a row where we have an early spring, according to the furry little fella, that's the first time that's happened, because most years, I think it's like in the average 9 out of 10 years, he does see his shadow, and that means, you know, 6 more weeks of winter. So,
all right, now what you can do for the next show that you're on is do a study and find out the years, the election years, and how it corresponds to, in other words, the groundhog seeing a shadow, Republican win, or Democrat win. And then give me some background on that.
I'm all over that.
Yeah,
man.
You think so?
I'm all over that.
You
I love
put it on
stuff
the website,
like that.
Man.
Yes, I think that's a great idea.
All right,
that's a great idea.
You don't have to give me any credit. Let's go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. Catherine and Troy. Catherine.
Hello.
Hello.
So my question is, why, when you turn on the weather, whether it's Spectrum, whether it's Channel 6, Channel 10, Channel 13, it's all different. Aren't you folks all using the same, like, National Weather Service? How can the weather be so different depending on what channel you listen to?
Well, I will say that meteorologists don't we'll consult with the National Weather Service. I always like to read their forecast discussion. There's some very bright men and women that are good forecasters over there. So I just kind of like to use that as a check. But, you know, any forecaster, particularly a meteorologist, they're going to have their own methods. As far as TV stations being that off from each other, I don't know. I can't speak to that. I never paid it when I was on the air. I never paid attention to what the other guys said, and I'm sure they didn't pay attention to what I said.
Yeah.
You know.
Does anybody pay? In other words, besides Catherine, is anybody keeping score?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that there's some folks out there that might do that. But I mean, can you give me an example of what you mean, Catherine? Is it temperatures? Is it snowfall amounts? What is it?
Yes. Yeah, and go a little deeper on the answer too. Yeah, like for example, snowfall amount in a storm. You know, one channel says 2 to 4, one channel says 6 to 8. And so I would think with you all being professionals, meteorologists, that you would all gather your info that you're going to put out to us from the same sources. Is that not correct then?
Well, I will tell you this. I mean, first of all, that's a big – when you have one outlet saying 2 to 4 and another one 6 to 8 for the same area, that's a big spread. So I'm not sure like what that is all about. But, you know, there are – I will tell you that forecasting in any area, you are relying not only on your forecasting ability but also your experience. In other words, if I were to get – somebody were to take me and drop me off in Salt Lake City or – you know, Tempe, Arizona, or someplace like that, I would be lost for a while because you get the feel for a place. There's a lot of there's a lot of qualitative aspects to forecasting, but a lot of quantitative too, where you just kind of, you know, you're looking at certain things and you go, you know, I remember this happened a couple of years ago or this pattern that we're in. So the only thing that I'm only speculating that might be the culprit in terms of having such a wide range in snowfall accumulation forecast is that mixed precipitation will crush your forecast. It is a drag. What you don't want is to forecast snow and, well, we're going to go over to sleet in a few hours and then that sleet shows up earlier.
Yep.
You're in a lot of trouble because sleet will destroy that forecast. So you might have, and again, I'm just speculating, but you might have, you know, one guy, LaPointe, saying, well, I think we're going to go over to sleet earlier. And you might have Cap going, oh, I think we're going to hang on to snow longer. And that would be the difference. Again, I'm just speculating.
All right, Catherine, we got to take a break here. Jason Goff is our guest. It's Weather Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. If you have a question about the weather, 1-800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Fox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's Weather Today. Meteorologist Jason Goff from jasonsweather.com joins us today in a couple of emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from Mark. Whenever I travel up into the Catskills or the Adirondacks, the weather's completely different. Can you please explain this? Why is it that places up in higher elevations experience different types of weather than everybody else?
Ah, that's a very good question. So a couple things. One, temperature-wise, it's just colder in higher elevations, generally speaking, unless you have a temperature inversion. But things get colder as you go higher up from the ground. The reason for that is that the sun does not heat the air directly. It heats the ground, which then radiates the heat back around. So so that's that. And then as far as precipitation goes, you get basically, if you want to get a cloud, let's say you want to make yourself a little rain shower, you have to get moisture up into the atmosphere. And you can do that in a couple of different ways. You can do that with a cold front, right, which is basically a picture like a bulldozer, if you will, kind of lifting all that moisture up into the air, cools, condenses, your water cycle kicks in.
Yeah.
So you have that. You have an upper level storm. You know, it could be a little low-level jet. It could be a little upper-level low, whatever. And that, in essence, will help to draw moisture up almost like a vacuum cleaner. Think about it like that. The other thing is what we call orographic lift.
I'm sorry?
That's what it is.
All right.
Orographic lift. There's your new word for the day.
Fine.
So as air moves along, it's not going to blow through the mountain. It's got to go up over it. So that will also help to get that moisture up which, again, it cools. Okay. So that's why you tend to have, especially like in the springtime, as we'll be coming into here in the next, whatever, 5-6 weeks, you'll have that deck of stratocumulus clouds, for example, and they'll hang out over the mountains longer than they will in the valleys. So the valleys will tend to clear out sooner than the mountains will. That's just the way that we roll.
You get lenticular clouds, too, over by the mountains, too, right?
Yeah, they're a little rare around here. You don't see them there. You typically will get those over bigger mountain ranges. You see a lot of those. I've seen a lot of pictures from, like, Mount Hood and some of those bigger spots out west.
So cool to see,
yeah. They're so neat. I mean, I can't imagine, like, the American Indians back in the day seeing that and going, wow.
This one is from somebody. Oh, Randy. Randy writes, why do winter temperatures typically fluctuate more than summer temperatures? For instance, we can get a 70-degree swing going from minus 20 to plus 50 within a day or two, but in the summer, we don't get such a rapid and wide temperature swing.
That's a good question. We actually get our bigger temperature swings tend to be in the transitional seasons. We'll see that, especially like in the fall.
Yeah.
If you have one of those really just dry days, bluebird skies, not a cloud in the sky, and you might have a low of 40 and a high of 75.
Yeah.
And that's when your dew points are really low. So just like, liquid water, water vapor tends to moderate your temperatures as well. And in the summertime, we have more water vapor available in the atmosphere. So, and especially if we get into some of these hotter patterns, yeah, our temperatures may fluctuate like 20 degrees. But in the wintertime, our big temperature swings will come from wind directional changes. So if we have, it happened the other morning. Yesterday morning and the morning before, Old Forge, the morning before last, was 20 below. Wow. Yesterday morning, it was 29 above. That's a 49-degree temperature swing in 24 hours.
Yeah.
So, it's just we're just in a little bit of a – wind direction is huge this time of year.
I would not want to be – I would love to be a plumber up there, but I would not want to have water pipes. Oh. That's what I hate the most. I mean, a couple of years ago, we had that terrible cold snap. Was it last year or the year before? Where it was very, very cold for a couple of days, and then it got warm.
Oh.
And there went the pipe.
Yeah, that can happen.
Yep.
But, the folks up there are, that's a way of life for them, as far as dealing with the cold and the temperature swing. So they just roll with it.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. Mary in Delmar. Mary, you're up.
Hi there. I have a question about clouds and what clouds to be worried about. I mean, between the extremes of like the cute little puffballs in the sky versus a funnel cloud barreling down at you, which cloud patterns are more or less worrisome?
I'll take this one. I think that I'd be more concerned about a funnel cloud.
Yes, that's a fact.
Oh, I think so.
Yes.
But in the middle is what I'm wondering about.
I see.
Yeah, so you typically, when we get into the spring and into the summer, you get cumulus clouds that'll pop up. And if the atmosphere above that is pretty stable, then that's all you get. You just get these little, whatever you want to call them, cotton balls or mashed potatoes or whatever. It's as we get into more energy in the atmosphere, less stability aloft, that you can get these clouds. The cumulus clouds just continue to grow, and then they become cumulonimbus clouds, meaning they have rain in them. And then as they continue to get taller, then you get ice in them, and then that's how you get lightning going and so on. So those are the clouds that you've got to check out the most in terms of that. Now, this time of year, a little bit of a different story. Today is a kind of a good example. We have this low deck of stratus clouds. It's a good thing that we're at 35, 36 degrees around most of the area. It's colder in the Adirondacks, but these are the types of days where these clouds would be a headache because they could spit out these little patches of drizzle, occasional showers. But if that falls on ground that's at 30 degrees, then you got icing issues.
Yeah.
So pick your poison, so to speak.
All right, Mary, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is the number. Weather today and Peter in Warren, Mass. Peter.
Hi. I was wondering if meteorologists ever developed a way of measuring the lightning and electromagnetivity to measure the intensity of a thunderstorm?
Yes. There's continues to be a lot of research on that. Especially when it comes to tornadoes, because they will sometimes you will see a spike in electrical activity in lightning in a storm.
Measured
and
how?
It'll kind of you, just through the lightning detection network. You can okay. see the flashes, you know, as it's displayed, and so they're trying to develop a correlation to that. Generally speaking, obviously, the stronger the storm is, the more lightning you're going to have out of it. But as they're trying to figure out why certain storms throw more lightning than others. The thing that just popped into my mind, getting away from the tornadoes, but there was a big derecho that happened here in 95, I think.
A what?
It's called the derecho. And it is basically, it's a Spanish word, and it is a big cluster of thunderstorms, and it moves very quickly, and it is open for business.
Yeah.
There was one that came through, and I have to look it up now because I actually wasn't even living here at the time when it came through, but it came through the Adirondacks and just wiped out a million trees, literally a million trees, and there was a tremendous amount of lightning that came out of that. I've seen the radar the loops from that, and it's just you can barely see the precip as it's depicted on the radar because it's just covered in lightning. So it's a really wild thing to check out. Certainly there's a lot of research that's done on that and will continue to be done.
All right, Peter, thank you very much for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest today, and now we go on over to John in Canaan. John.
Hi, gents. I've got two related questions. Number one has to do with the forecast for the rest of the winter. Are we going to be basically what we've been having so far? Is winter basically over, or is there more to come? And the second question is, are there any good sources of long-term weather forecasting, you know, like for a season?
We've talked about this, and that's a sketchy proposition.
It is indeed. Good question is just the same. So I guess if I was a little braver, I would go ahead and pull the plug on this winter and say we're done. That's not to say that we can't get a whopping storm in March, because certainly,
April.
Or April, that's right, for that matter. But in terms of, like, you know, having a serious cold, I just don't see it. The polar vortex, which, you know, got a lot of play a few years ago, and, you know, it's a big part of our winters in the Northern Hemisphere, not just in the United States, that's been pretty healthy. And as the polar vortex is healthy, it stays wrapped around the North Pole. And so those real big shots of cold air that are, you know, extended in time, we don't get them, and we haven't gotten them. So we're going to get a little taste of that late Friday, as I said, and early Saturday. Saturday will be a pretty cold day, and then temperatures are going to swing back up. Now, as far as the long-range predictions go for a season, National Center for Environmental Prediction, NSEP, they put out outlooks, and they do it. It's an 8 to 14 days, that is. Then they'll have a monthly outlook. They'll have seasonal outlooks. They do that every quarter. To be honest with you, I don't pay a lot of attention to them. They're a lot less relevant in this part of the country than they are in others. So, but I would just do a search, check it out, go to the Weather Prediction Center, go to the Climate Prediction Center. There's a few places where you can get that information, and you'll see maps and all kinds of things.
Our guest today is meteorologist Jason Goff. His website is jasonsweather.com. And now over to Brian in Cornwall. Brian.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Sure thing.
Yes, sir.
Great. So my question sort of involves lots of learning from just this show in your answers to the other folks. But more specifically, I sort of don't care about the long term and whether it's going to snow or not, whether it's going to rain or not. And I'm lost in the information. As an example, my TV flashes every time there's a high wind alert somewhere in New York State,
right,
and it doesn't affect me. How do I get calm to know that I'm going to know if I'm saying it jokingly, the big storm, or something that I really need to care about? All I'm able to figure out is ignore, and it's winter.
You bring up a really good point, and it's a pet peeve of mine, especially the EAS, which I think is just ridiculously outdated.
When you're watching the game, and
and it's just, you know, it comes across.
Absolutely.
You know, people don't. I mean, I know county geography around here pretty well, but a lot of people don't, just because they're not into it all the time. So, right. You know, if somebody says, well, there's a, you know, whatever in southwestern Albany County, well, what the heck does that mean?
Right.
Where is that? You know what I
right.
mean? Like, give me something with some context to it. And then stations, you know, some stations will actually even put up like a county map. They call it a bug on a TV. It's a waste of space because,
yeah.
you know, unless you, again, are a geographer and you know this area inside and out with all the county outlines and stuff, that doesn't tell you anything. And
yeah.
the whole idea is to be able to communicate these things. And then on the other side of it, you don't want exactly what Brian is saying. Like, you don't want to be overwarned because that can get dangerous.
Right.
And I'll give you a good example of that. Back in Joplin, Missouri in 2011, 195 people were killed by a tornado. It was a huge tornado outbreak that day in the Midwest. And they interviewed, I think it was a television station.
I lived in Missouri at the time.
Oh, did you? Okay.
I know that example well.
Yeah. So this woman was on there and she brought up a great point. That tornado came through her neighborhood at like 4 p.m. And she's like, man, I've been hearing tornado watches and warnings all day.
Yeah.
So you get what's called warning fatigue. And a lot of folks don't know the difference between a watch and a warning. And so I always say you watch for a warning. That's a good way to remember it. Or I have a little graphic on there. And the watch is the woman in The Wizard of Oz and then the Margaret Hamilton. And then the warning is the Wicked Witch.
Oh, boy.
So that's the warning piece. So just to kind of, you know, remind people that that's what it is. You know, it's just one of those things where television stations now, they continue to lose viewership and weather is really their big hook, and they're going to do whatever they can to try to keep people to watch their stations.
Brian, thanks a lot. But some of that, the crawl, the red line that goes through and then the cutting of your sound, that is mandated by the state, right?
It's mandated by the feds.
Okay.
But it's worthless. It doesn't tell you anything. If you have to rely on television stations, now, if a situation is bad enough, then you get what we call in the business a cut-in, and that's when you have somebody sitting on there, you know, you break into programming. That's not only necessary for the safety of your viewers, that's also federally mandated. So you have to do that. And sometimes people will get hacked off, and I talked to a guy one time, he was mad because we broke into whatever the show was, and I said, okay, man, I'll tell you what. Next time there's a warning, I won't go on the air. And then when the station gets a bill from the SEC for $40,000
you
for not going
yeah.
on it, then we'll just forward that on to you.
Well, you make a point. You know, one thing I do like, though, and you mentioned the weather maps being vague when you see it pop up on your screen during a warning, is the National Weather Service, if you have a scanner or if you're listening to it on the radio,
mm-hmm.
they will often say, this storm will be by Duanesburg
yes.
at 2:45,
yep.
and then it will be by Altamont, blah, blah, blah. And it's very accurate.
Yes.
You can say, okay, kids, the storm's going to be through town now in a minute, and it's amazing.
Yes, it's very good. And they, you know, and it is the Weather Service that is solely responsible for issuing these warnings, and they do, I mean, again, I can't say it enough, that the meteorologists at the Weather Service office in Albany are awesome.
Yeah.
And they, you know, when they put out warnings, they will put it out and they'll say the storm is here. And then, you know, even up in the Adirondacks, these small little campgrounds and stuff that only maybe some locals or people that visit up there might know about.
Yeah.
They put all that information out there because, again, the goal is to let people know, hey, if you are in the path of the storm, you need to take cover. This thing is open for business.
Jason Goff is our guest. 800-348-2551. Frank in Clifton Park. Frank.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Now, the past couple of days, there have been stories about commercial jets getting a boost from a strong tailwind.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I heard
that.
That
was huge.
Yeah, and it got me thinking about jet streams and the climate change, and how will that affect jet streams as time goes on if we don't rein in the climate change as it is?
Well,
will that make the jet stream stronger? Or
It depends, because, you know, the Earth is a system, right? You have...
Yeah.
Land, you have water, and you have air. And as different sections of the earth heat up, you know, land and water heat up at a much different rate and all of that. But as the oceans continue to absorb heat, that's what the issue is. And that will in turn affect what's going on in the atmosphere. So the problem is at this stage of the game, the overall predictability of these things. So, you know, can we sit here and say, well, but not for climate change, then that flight would not have made it over to Heathrow in whatever it was, less than five hours. You know, you can't say that definitively. I mean, I'm always going to lean toward climate change on anything, you know, obviously, but it's just a function of trying to predict these things and trying to nail down, you know, what the effects overall are going to be. And that's a much more complicated arena.
You know, that story was great. And I think it was NPR, maybe it was the BBC the other day that had this. But the pilots know about this. Guys who fly and women who fly across from England to the U.S. and back, or from Europe to North America and back, they know about this. And it's happened before. What I have trouble comprehending is they went 800 miles an hour. They didn't break the sound barrier because they're going with the wind.
They're going with the wind.
It's amazing.
That's right. Yes, that's the important distinction. You're absolutely right. It is. It's really cool because they were just basically along for the ride.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, the jet stream was basically discovered in World War II with fighter pilots, and they figured it out from there. So yeah, it generally will take you. You know, they'll figure out where the jet stream is if you're flying from Heathrow back to New York or wherever, because you don't want to have that big headwind. You burn more fuel.
Yeah. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest. Weather on the Vox Pop program today. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. It's 800-348-2551. Jason Goff is our guest today. A couple of emails here. Boy, the phone lines and the email box have been full. And yeah. This one is from Jeff in Rotterdam. Two questions. We've all heard about global warming causing rising seas. What's the prognosis for the Capital District? Palm trees. Wait a minute. Okay, well, let's just go to number two here. I don't think I get that one.
I don't think we'll have palm trees here anytime soon.
I've heard that the Gulf Current is in peril. If it goes away or moves substantially, how will it affect us?
Well, that's the Gulf Stream that he's referring to, and they're talking about the possibility of that's been modeled that it'll actually go a little farther south, so it'll be colder north. It affects... I mean, in essence, that's what's responsible for the fog that you get like south of Newfoundland and then over into England. It's a foggy place because of that. You have the colder air going over that warmer water, to say nothing of all the fisheries and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, it's not good. I mean, as I said before, the Earth is a system. And what the Earth is always trying to do that it can never do is to make everything on the planet
equal.
Yeah. And so that's why we have the Gulf Stream, for example. It carries that warmer water up from the equator.
Yeah.
And then on the other side of the country, you have the California Current. So that's why the water, even in San Diego, is a lot colder than it's going to be off of, let's say, Charleston.
Huh.
And certainly off of any of the coast of Florida, because you have that California Current that's bringing that colder water down.
All right, this one's from our buddy Jules. Jules writes, how often do we get temperature inversions in the Hudson River Valley?
Oh, we get them quite a bit. We get them.
For those who don't know, tell them what it is.
So a temperature inversion is generally you have in the atmosphere, it gets colder as you go higher up. In the case of a temperature inversion, it's just the opposite. It's warmer aloft. And if you don't have something to mix that out, be it a lot of sunshine or a gusty wind, then it kind of sits there, and that'll bring you a day like this.
Now,
where you've got kind of foggy, and it's a little this, a little of that. So it happens pretty often.
Do you need clouds for an inversion? In other words, what keeps the cold weather down and the warm weather above it, warm air above it?
It'll just be whatever else is going on in the atmosphere above our head. So it'll bring in that warmer air, and it'll just basically just kind of sit there.
Yeah.
If we're in that little pattern. And then typically, you know, you'll get an inversion at night, you know, in the early morning hours where it's colder, but they can certainly sit there all day. And, you know, we can get inversions pretty much any time.
Yeah.
But they tend to happen, you know, again, more in the transitional seasons, and even in winter, they happen less in summer.
And is that what makes the stars appear to kind of twinkle and move around a little bit?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question.
Like lensing effects?
That could be.
All right. This one, I love this. This is from Gene in Dismal, Del Mar. Gene writes, it seems this has been the darkest winter in many years because most of our weather this winter has been lingering low-pressure storms coming up from the south instead of cold, clear, high-pressure storms from the north. Can you correct or affirm that?
I can affirm it. Although, you know, we've had our fair amount of sunshine this winter, but certainly today, again, not the prettiest day we've ever seen.
Oh, my gosh.
But it's, yeah, I mean, you know, and because we tend to be on the milder side winter-wise, she's right. We don't have those big ridges of high pressure that tends to bring our highest pressure of the year usually will come this time. And that's when we have those bright blue skies. And, you know, you get those days in January where there's not a cloud in the sky and the temperature is like 15 degrees.
Yeah. All right. Well, there's nothing we can do about that.
No,
Dismal
I wish.
Del Mar, but you'll have to pull through. This is Gary in Schenectady. Gary, you're on.
Yes, guys, really interesting show as always, and thanks a lot for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to throw a little meteorological insight onto Groundhog's Day and what it comes from and what it's all about, because it's part you didn't bring up. February 2nd is a cross-quarter day, which means it's exactly between the winter solstice and the spring equinox. It's called Candlemas or Imbolc. And all the cross-quarter days have a lot of interesting mythology around them. Another one you might be familiar with is All Hallows' Eve on October the 31st.
Yes.
That, too, is a cross-quarter day.
Splendid.
But February the 2nd, the legend is from England, where badgers slept all winter, as did snakes, that on February the 2nd, the cross-quarter day on Imbolc, they would stick their heads out and see, are we closer to spring or closer to winter, because we're right in between. If it was nice out, out they came, and that was that, and that tradition carried over, and we used groundhogs. It was originally badgers or snakes.
Well, I'll be darned.
Hey, that's cool,
you
man.
See,
thank
you ask a WAMC listener, you get an answer. Gary, thank you
that's
very
it.
Much for the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Looks like Dave in Altamont is next. Dave.
Yes. Hi, Jason. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, sir.
I have an answer to one of your earlier statements and the question. The answer is that storm you were talking about that blew through and knocked down a lot of trees happened around 95, 96 because we were camping in the Adirondacks at the time.
Yes.
And
no,
it was
sir,
open for business, as you said. My question is, how is the sunrise and sunset time calculated for the Albany area? We're not on the edge of the time zone, so can you explain how that works?
No, we're not, certainly not, but it basically it is, there's a function of latitude and longitude have to do with the sunrise and sunset times, and you, because the sun's rays are refracted, they're kind of bent, they actually calculate it, and they'll calculate, if I'm remembering this right now.
Nautical and
yeah, and because you'll see it like timeanddate.com is a really good site for all this kind of stuff. And they'll have like, you know, what the sun angle is in the sky, and they'll have, you know, what they call civil twilight and all that sort
yeah.
of thing. So it has to do with as the sun is coming up over the horizon, the rays actually kind of bend around that, and then they figure it out. Essentially from this, what the sun angle is at that latitude, and then they'll figure out the sunrise from there. So it's not actually the time where the sun pokes above the horizon. It's when those rays start to come up, and then they're calculated back from there.
Yeah, you know, I love it when we're at the ocean, and the sun actually rises. You see it before it actually rises.
Yes.
It's a very cool effect.
That is really cool.
And yet some people say the Earth is flat. It's very interesting.
Hey, man, takes all kinds, I guess.
Yeah, do you ever get any of those writing you at the website?
No.
No?
No.
Well, if you are a flat earther, please write Jason's Jason at jasonsweather.com and let him know. Let's go to Joanna in South Hadley. Joanna.
Hi there. I live in Western Mass, and I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about microbursts and or wind shear.
Yeah.
About 6 years ago, there was one of those two that came through East Hampton, Mass, and literally snapped all the mature trees halfway up on the East Hampton side of the Mount Tom Range, and it's still not grown back. It looks hideous.
Okay.
How often do these happen, and is it possible to warn people about them in advance? Because if that had hit East Hampton rather than the mountainside, there could have been devastation.
All right, we're going to turn you down, but we'll leave you here, Joanna. You sounds like you have an emergency broadcast going on in the background. Your phone has got a terrible hum.
Gotcha, but we're good now. So there's a lot to get to in there, so I'll do that quickly. Can they be detected? Absolutely. In and around airports, they have what are known as terminal Doppler radar, where they can detect wind changing directions with height. That's very important for planes. We had a couple of plane crashes in the 1980s that were a result of wind shear, what they called at the time wind shear. One in Dallas and one in New Orleans, 83 in New Orleans, 85 in Dallas.
Yeah.
And what happens is essentially what a microburst is a storm that is basically just releasing a lot of energy, and you get a column of wind that comes rushing down. It's cold, right? It's coming down from the top of the storm. So it's going to come down, it's going to hit the ground, and then it obviously it's not going to go through the ground, so it's going to radiate out in all directions. And you can see where the Weather Service sometimes will do surveys of these things, and you can see it from the air, especially now with drones and things. You can see actually where the core of the microburst hit, because all the trees basically lie out flat radially from that area. They tend to be small, relatively speaking, in size. But how often they happen, I don't have the data to back this up, but just from my own experience here, I would say on the average, maybe 2 out of every 3 years we'll have one, perhaps.
Yeah.
Maybe every other year, I'm not sure.
But a microburst, is that or is that not the same thing as wind shear?
It is, because wind shear was kind of the catch-all term that was used back in the day. But when you're talking about shear, in essence, what you're talking about is wind changing direction with height. And so what you're having is, you know, if you have winds that are around a microburst that are going to be blowing in whatever direction, but these things, the wind is coming down, and it actually – what happens is planes will get into these things, and they can either get pushed into the ground, or they'll throttle up and they'll try to get out of it, and then they get pushed. It's just a bad thing. So now with this terminal Doppler radar, you can, and I think Albany Airport has 6. Mm-hmm. I might be wrong, 4 or 6, and they're placed around the airport, and then they can then tell you, you know, kind of like, hey, we've got a southwest wind here, whatever. And if it's during a thunderstorm or there's one nearby, then air traffic control can wave them off. Generally, that's kind of a last, you know, you want to have an idea, obviously, before you're on final approach that this could be a possibility. But it's a good fail-safe, and now the airports around the country have them for that reason, for air traffic safety.
And to your knowledge, has that improved landing safety?
Oh, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. There was a plane. There have been a few plane crashes. There was one in Little Rock, I think, in the late 90s. And I don't want to speak out of this, but I think what happened was, in essence, they had to get the plane on the ground. They knew they were flying into a bad situation, and
they had to
prove to be right. Yeah.
All right, let's go to Chris in Queensbury. Chris.
Hi. I have a quick question. I live in Queensbury, and I've noticed that the thunderstorms are usually more intense in Saratoga and north up in Lake George, and I didn't know why that was. I didn't know if it was because of a mountain that may stop the storm, but there seems to be pockets of very intense storms, and Queensbury is generally spared.
Hmm. Well, I don't really, I wish I had some data to back that up. It could be a perception that you're having. That's not to say that, you know, if you live in Queensbury, you're immune from a storm that would be less nasty, for example, than it would be in Saratoga, especially because you're not talking about a very long distance.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the distance is between Saratoga and Queensbury. It can't be but 10 or 12 miles as the crow flies.
But I noticed that, too, with our winter storms, is that the degree of intensity – as you go up the north way, there's always pockets.
Yes. Now that's a different story, and what happens is it's not so much a function of one place over another. It's more of what's going on with that actual storm, because you can see pockets. Ray and I were talking about this off the air, just in terms of having like different snowfall forecasts, and the idea is to be a little broader than to be more specific, because you're going to have little pockets where you know, let's say, speaking of Saratoga County, if you're out like in the northwestern part of the county, you're starting to get up in elevation as you head out toward Greenfield and Porter Corners and all of that. So, you know, that depending on, you know, where the storm is, where the center of the storm is, you might be able to get a little more snow up there because it's a little higher in elevation. And you'll have little pockets. And I've heard, you know, like out in western Schenectady County, they'll get more, again, as a function of a higher elevation. So it just depends on how things set up. But it's not, you can't broad brush it and say, well, every winter storm is going to be worse in one spot than another. It's just each storm is different, and some places are going to get more snow than others.
But Chris, you're specifically talking about spring and fall and winds, right?
Wind and, wind.
Hmm. That could be a function of terrain, right?
It could be. Yep. Again, it just depends on how everything is settled up. We can get funneling. There are some times where you'll have the immediate, like Capital District, the snow can just keep on going because you're getting these winds that are funneling and you're getting what's called convergence. So you're, in essence, you're kind of perpetuating the storm, whereas in other places it'll fizzle out.
Yeah.
But again, every spot is different. Every storm is different. Certain places are going to get more snow that, you know, the Catskills are not going to get generally as much snow as the Adirondacks are. That's generally a given. But
just altitude there?
Just, well, the Adirondacks are a little farther north. It's colder in the Adirondacks than it is in the Catskills, you know, in any given winter overall. And then it also, again, it depends on the track of a storm, where it's going, how intense it is, and all of that.
All right, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Let's try to grab another one here before we wrap it up, and we go to Adam in Pittsfield. Yikes. Adam, you're on.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I had a question about the business of predicting the weather. I find myself looking on my phone a lot, and it is installed with an AccuWeather app.
Ugh.
And I was recently reading a Mike and Michael Pollan book referencing the CEO of AccuWeather, who has been installed in the Trump administration, who sounds like he is trying to take over weather predicting and eliminate or sort of obfuscate NOAA. Is that true? Is there some sort of truth behind the business of predicting the weather?
Well, that's a kind of a double-pronged question. I think it was a Barry or Joel Myers, one of the guys. They were not installed. Whoever it was, I don't believe is actually made it in, which is, you know, in a sense, he would have fit perfectly in the Trump administration. Just steal anything that's not nailed down, and you're all set. So. And Ray just smacks his head. So, but there is, you know, there is a forecasting deal that, you know, in terms of as a business, AccuWeather takes it to a ridiculous level. They have a 90-day forecast, which is absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
We're out of time, but are we going to get sued by AccuWeather for you saying that?
No.
Okay.
They can. I actually did a little study on it.
Can they email you directly if they want to complain?
They sure can.
What's your email address?
Jason@jasonsweather.com.
Well, thank you, sir. We appreciate you being here. Support comes from Daughters of Sarah, Albany, New York, providing assisted living, transitional care, rehabilitation therapy, and respite long-term and palliative care for seniors. Daughtersofsarah.org. Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, contact lenses, specialty sports eyewear, sunglasses, and eye exams since 1953. Sheehy Opticians.com. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, for over 30 years, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair and 24-hour towing. Full-service gas includes checking of fluids, tire pressure, and window washing. CollegeStreetMotors.com. And The Gift Garden, Bennington, Vermont. Florist and gift shop featuring fresh flowers, arrangements, gourmet gift baskets, home decor, candles, gifts, and more on Main Street. TheGiftGardenVT.com. Thanks again to Jason Goff for being here. Thank you for listening. Jason will be back, and of course he's on the web, and his link is on our page at wamc.org/voxpop. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, Susie Chekai for answering the phones, Jim Lavoulis and Jackie Orchard producing. Tomorrow, it's Pets und Vets. Dr. Carrie O'Loughlin will join us to answer your questions. Right now, stand by for the book show.